Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
You know, the market generally has been slow to get back to the period that we had just before COVID. But I know, Rebecca, you're going to say that that period before COVID was a bit of an anomaly because we had all of those deadlines.
Yeah, so Mona, back in 2019, right before that huge deadline we had, I know you say it's an anomaly, but at the same time, you can see throughout the years, the psychological effect of 500,000. It went up to 900,000. We saw it come back down again to 500,000. And then finally, when SRIA came out in March of 2022, we saw it now at 800,000. Investors are kind of hesitant because is there a possibility of it going back down to 500,000?
Well, I think that's wishful thinking. But as developers are understanding this hesitation that we are seeing with investors parting with 800,000 plus, I feel like some investors are becoming creative and devising alternative solutions. So today, to discuss what's going on, you know, is there a psychology of investing beyond 500,000 that is preventing a lot of investors? Plus, how are developers taking it? We have Manuel Ortez, Vice President of the Global Business Development with First Pathway Partners, joining us. Welcome, Manuel.
Hey, Mona. Thank you so much for having me here. It's great to be here again. I know we did this back in maybe 2019 or something like that. So glad to be back.
Time rushes by. Well, hope to have you back many times, Manuel, because you always put in, you have a great insight on all of these areas. Basically, because you've been in the EB5 arena for so long. How many years has it been?
So it's been about 10 years, and I've seen the program definitely change quite a bit. And it's really interesting. I've had the pleasure of working with investors from over 40 countries. And I was looking at just how many people I've worked with, and it's over 1,000. So it's just really good to get just a different perspective because every different region is going to be different.
Here, we really wanted to discuss whether or not there is a psychology behind investors being a little cautious now because they've only been used to investing 500,000. And Rebecca, I know you were talking about going up and down just a minute ago, but it was 500,000 for so many years, since the 90s.
Yes, it's so many years without, even though the prices for and everywhere else, the consumer price index has been going up, but EB5 still stayed the same until 2019.
It's interesting to understand a little bit about the background because EB5 was never intended to be 500,000. That was always a smaller amount who went into the target employment area. Back in 1990, when this was first put in legislation, it was supposed to be $1 million. But then all of the early regional centers wanted to compete with the big competitor at that time, which was Canada. And Canada was super popular with the Chinese, with the South Koreans, and Canada was at 450,000. So the big regional centers had to look around to find projects in TEAs, and slowly and bit by bit, they crept out of TEAs and became gerrymandered in cities. So
that almost became the norm, didn't it?
So we were looking at 500 being the norm. In fact, people didn't even understand that there was $1 million.
Right. And I think even if you look at that $500,000 number going back to 1990, if you adjust for inflation, that number now is over $1 million, right? If you take your example of it was meant to be $1 million back then, the number's even higher. And so, you know, while it does seem like it's a jump from the 500 to the 800,000 to where we are now, it's potentially going to continue to go up, right?
Well, yes. But if you hold on just before we get to that, psychologists actually say that on average, it takes 1.5 years for investors to really let it sink in and be able to move forward. And even the admin fee typically seems such a hike. But the point is here that I don't even think with the admin fee can go down because there are now so many more expenses, Manuel. I mean, as a regional center operative, aren't you seeing just a ton more expenses?
It is more expensive, definitely. And I think that's some of the stuff that you saw with the Reform Integrity Act. I think there's been a lot of positives as well. And I think that one of the positives is that, you know, those additional fees are also there in a way just to show who's really committed to EB5, right? I think gone are the days where people can just hold on to multiple regional centers and there are no fees associated with that. And so, you know, I think now to a certain degree, you definitely have the people that plan to be here for a long time, right? First Pathway, we've been here since 2008, and we plan to be here well into the future. And I think, you know, one of the other things, since we're talking about just expenses and how the cost has gone up, you know, another thing is that interest rates have also gone up and banks aren't lending as much as they were previously, right? So that puts pressure on the EB-5 rates because, you know, before, if a bank was lending, and let's just say 75 to 80% to loan to cost, well, now maybe they're at 55 or 60 and you have to make up the difference somewhere. And so that comes from EB-5.
Rebecca, source of fund legal fees have gone up also, not just the administrative fees, but the investment amount.
Yes, I think investors would love for us to have kept the same cost, but Mona, we've seen it's a lot more work. I mean, $800,000 we've seen. With 500, we've seen multiple sources for the investment. Now we're seeing even more than that. So it's a lot more work. It's a lot more forensic accounting, I would say, that we're going through the bank statements, trying to figure out every penny. And of course, with the admin fee going up to 80,000, you also have to include that with the sourcing. So it's a lot more to source, and the sources are a lot more difficult. You know, we've done crypto. I've been through cases with USCIS on this, and it's a lot of work to put into those types of cases. So, you know, loans, which we're going to get into later, all of that, it's a lot more complicated than it was in the past.
It's not that we're seeing differences in the net worth of investors. I think it's just the difficulties of getting money out of particular countries.
Well, one, there's the requirement of how much can come out of a country, right? Some of these countries have currency limitations. But at the same time, it's also difficult for them to liquidate assets. So we're seeing a lot of that. I think investors are taking their time just because it is taking time for them to accumulate their $800,000 or $880,000 in addition to the source of funds legal fees. In addition to, you know, the integrity fees now have to be paid by investors, there's an additional $1,000 in that. So they are taking their time to accumulate their wealth to be able to pay all these fees.
Yeah, but Manuel and Rebecca, we're not going to see this money go down as much as everybody wants to go back to the good old days of 500,000, because the EB-5 Reform and Integrity Act has said what? That it's going to periodically increase? When is the next increase?
Well, the program was reauthorized for 5 years, right? And so at that point, we might see another increase. It just depends, I think. I think that's probably the soonest that we would see something.
I think they said automatic readjustments beginning January 1st of 2027, and then every 5 years thereafter based on the consumer price index.
Yeah, so we are seeing, I don't think it's discretionary. I think it's legislation, which means that everybody will, oh my God, there's going to be a rush then every 5 years.
Every 5 years, I know. Not only that, they also said that the integrity fee could also be increased just because they want to ensure that the amounts going into the fund are sufficient to carry out all these purposes the fund is supposed to do. So we could see increases in that. And then I think investors now have to, you know, realistically see that this is here to stay. It is not going back down to 500,000.
I have a question for you, Manuel. Developers obviously would be happy that they're getting more money and they have to do the same amount of jobs. But realistically, and you have a lot of very, very good projects all over the country, do developers need more money to meet the higher costs for their projects and to create the jobs? Or could they have managed with 500?
So I think there are a couple of things to consider whenever you think of costs, right? Because oftentimes we think of costs as the construction cost of the project. And obviously construction costs do go up. And so that is definitely something that is being faced now. But I think also the other thing is just the general cost of where interest rates are now. And so that's definitely impacting the amount of capital that you need to raise. So if a lender was lending 75 to 80% of the value or cost of a project, well, you know, now maybe it's 55 or 60%. And so now you have to raise more EB-5. And I think that the investment amount going from 500 to 800,000 also means that you are raising from, you know, not much, but you are raising from a little bit of a smaller population of people as well. And so the timing of the funding for each particular project also is critical in this.
Right. That brings us onto a really good point. Are we seeing a different type of EB-5 investor?
I think you are definitely seeing an EB-5 investor that is more informed. And I think that's a really good thing. I think the challenge for the EB-5 investor today is really cutting through the clutter, because there is so much information out there that some of it is just misinformation. So from a due diligence perspective, it's really important to cut through the clutter and be able to study a project both on its immigration merits and on the investment merits, because for it to be a successful EB-5 project, it has to have both. One dictates whether you're going to get your permanent residency, and the other dictates whether you're going to get your capital back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, talking about increasing our fees, I mean, we also, Rebecca, we also have the fee hike for government fees. But weren't you telling me that some investors don't really care about it, even though the fees are really doubling and tripling?
Oh, yes. I think it goes back to that psychological effect, in that now that the funds have increased, they also are cautious of where they're spending it. Investors are savvy now. They've seen the program through the years, and they've seen it go through COVID. Unfortunately, a lot of projects also didn't do well coming out of COVID. You know, a lot of them weren't able to pay back investors, or they're slow at paying back just because they have to catch up from COVID. So I think a lot of them are hesitant or making sure that they're conducting their due diligence. There's no real deadline anymore. They don't mind paying a few thousand dollars more for an increase in the filing fee, whereas they want to be sure they get back the $800,000.
That's a really good point that a lot of investors are seeing now, that it's not about the big glamorous real estate of New York City and Los Angeles and et cetera. In a way, it gives rural a chance, because with glamorous projects taking a hit, I think people are ready to see if projects in smaller towns and in unheard of places previously are actually good projects. Do you agree, Manuel?
Most definitely. And I think there what's really important for investors to consider is, what's the actual value of the asset that is there? And what's the plan for the exit, right? And what's going to happen in a worst case scenario? And so I think, you know, there's definitely a rush for rural projects. We've seen that, but I think it's very important for investors just to also, again, just really consider the investment merits for an EB-5 project. What's the business case for it? Does this type of development even make sense? What's the collateral behind it? Those sorts of things are the things that investors really need to consider, because again, that's definitely going to impact their ability to get their capital back.
Yeah, but you know, sometimes there are factors which you don't even think of at the time of investing. We've seen a couple of senior living homes which really got hurt by COVID. And then after COVID, when all the money got thrown at them, they couldn't get the right staff to come in. And then the interest rates hit. So it wasn't one thing. It was like a triple whammy of items. And then I think after that, it really comes down to the structuring of the project. If it's debt heavy, it really just wasn't able to survive.
That's right. I think you're exactly right. And then it goes back to how much of it was actually EB-5. Was EB-5 80% of what the project is, or was it 14%, 15%? It really just depends on how a project is structured and how the investor is actually protected. Again, it goes back to the collateral that is actually there. And there are going to be market forces there, right? I think that there's always an interest for, hey, how soon can an investor get their capital back, right? That's the one thing that you always hear. But I also think that's important to consider that these types of projects sometimes are a little bit longer term, because that longer term is there to adjust for these different cycles that you go through, right? And what is happening is that sometimes you get caught on the wrong side of it if it's a short-term project, whereas a longer-term project, it helps you just, the longer tail helps you weather the storm a little bit better.
Does it make any difference, do you feel, Manuel, that if there is a higher amount, sort of an equity part from the developer, does that really make any difference? Or does it really just depend on the project's viability?
I think you definitely want to have developer equity or sponsor equity in a project because it just makes sure that they have skin in the game and it makes sure that all interests are aligned. I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Mona, we've seen investors always ask that question. They always ask whether the developer has equity or, like you said, skin in the game. They want to see that. And I think that makes them, not to say it's a safe project or anything, but it makes them feel a bit better knowing that hey, look, the developer also has something in the project as well.
Well, and back when the investment amount was 500,000, it might not have mattered as much. But now at 800, at 900,000, I think that, I mean, it is almost 900 by the time the admin fees and all the other fees are paid. I do think the psychology of the investor is very different. Speaking of which, there are a number of projects which are basically helping the investors get over this psychological impasse by giving them loans. So we're seeing loans from regional centers and from projects. Manuel, EB5 is cheap capital. Does getting a loan from an institution like this make sense to the regional center?
You know, I think that one of the important things to look at here is just from the investor perspective, right? Because you always see new products come out. And again, being in the industry for about 10 years now, and you know, Mona, you've been in EB5 for a long time as well, it's that we see these different types of products come up from time to time. If you remember back in like 2015, 2016, there was this EB5 insurance project that came out, right? And then that kind of didn't work out. And so, you know, I think from the investor standpoint, I think it's really important just to consider what the actual costs are. But at the same time, for us, it's too early to determine how USCIS is going to treat these applications. And so I think there's still some questions to kind of be answered there as well.
Rebecca, you have some thoughts here.
Yeah, I think the investors just conduct your due diligence, know what's happening, know the terms, where are these loans coming from? What is the terms of the loan? I think a lot of these are going to have high interest, and then the investor is going to be responsible for paying that interest as well. So at the end of the day, you could potentially be paying more than the investment amount that was supposed to be given. So you're looking at a lot more costs when you're looking at that. I'm also hesitant on that because if it's coming from the project itself, like, who are they working with? Where are they getting this capital? At the same time, my issue is that the intent of this program is to bring foreign capital into the U.S., right, for job creation. Yeah. So if the project can go out and get the funding from the very beginning, are they circumventing or is even at the EB5 investor, could it be potentially that they're circumventing a way of getting the capital into the U.S. versus bringing in their own?
Are you referring to the section in REIA which says that loans should not circumvent the rules, meaning that we're not going to accept a loan if we think that you are just trying to get over what we want you to do in the act?
Yeah.
And I'm presuming what USCIS means by that, or rather what Congress means by that, is the fact that if your capital is not clean, you're just going to go and get a loan, which quite frankly, Rebecca, so many investors do.
Exactly. And so what are the projects doing with that? Are they actually looking at the assets? Is it a collateralized loan? You know, are they just giving the loan as is? So there's so many issues when it comes to loans, which we'll probably get into more as well, because with investors and how they want to be paid. Because one of the other issues is that you're putting, let's say, for instance, you're putting in 400,000 of your own capital. The project is loaning you the other 400,000. And I've seen this, or I've not seen it, but I've heard from investors asking, well, can I not just repay that loan 2 years or 3 years down the road? To me, that looks like you want to take the capital that's returned back to you, that 400,000, just to repay the loan. So at the end of the day, are you really investing $800,000? Did the investor actually give $800,000? I feel like it's some gray areas. Not to say that loans can't be done. It can be done. I just think you need to be careful on how you're drafting these documents.
Yes, good point.
Rebecca, you bring up a really good point too. I think one other point to mention as well is that you are seeing projects that are different now as well. And I think that if you're you know, getting a loan for that, you know, let's call it again, like you said, for $400,000, the lender, whoever's giving that loan, still needs to recuperate that capital, right? And so if the project is going to be a pioneering type project and it doesn't work out, you still have to pay the interest on that $400,000, and the lender still has to recuperate those $400,000. And chances are, it's probably, if there's any capital left, going to come out of your initial $400,000 investment. And so you could end up in a complete wipeout situation pretty quickly utilizing this strategy as well.
Yes. You know, a lot of investors are asking that because of this whole, when can your $800,000 be repaid? All right. So the regulations, right, there is some confusion on this, but it seems that you can get repaid within, you know, after 2 years or so. You don't have to wait till the I-829 is filed. Investors are looking at that and trying to find a way of how can they get repaid back quickly? And so doing something like that, taking a loan out and not having to repay that loan till 2 years down the road, again, if projects are promising to pay investors back within that 2 year period, we're looking at issues when it comes to that.
Well, one more area which this whole psychology of investing only 500 brings up is the fact that a lot of investors aren't able to immediately come up with 800,000 for a number of reasons. And many of it is the transfer of funds from certain countries. So we are seeing an increase of partial payments. Manuel, do you accept, do you like to get partial payments? I suppose nobody likes to get partial payments, but do you accept it in your regional center?
We do accept partial payments, but I think it is on a case-by-case basis. And we also don't like to get too far away from the job creation either, right? Because you still have to tie your investment to the job creation. And if you get too far away from that, your risk on the immigration side gets higher and higher.
But it doesn't stop you from accepting that particular somebody coming into your project who said, look, I only have 100 now. And I can give you another 300,000 maybe in 2 years and the rest in a year after that.
Well, I think typically for us, what we like to stick to is, you know, within about a 90-day time frame. And again, it's going to be on a case-by-case basis, but we really do like to be a little bit more on the conservative side of this. You know, I've heard longer timelines than that. But, you know, for us, again, it's very important to be able to keep as close as you can to the job creation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Manuel. We advise our clients the same. I mean, yes, we've done some at 180 days, so 6 months out. And those are like extenuating circumstances. But at the same time, you know, the reason why a lot of people go for partial filings is because, for instance, age outs, or for instance, if there's going to be backlogs, like for India, for instance, or China, you know, these new set-asides, yes, they're free. They have, visas are available. They could potentially see backlogs. So people are just trying to get in to get that priority, the earlier priority date. So I think that's where partial payments are becoming popular because of those issues.
And Rebecca, one other thing as well with this whole partial payment topic as well is that if you start taking too many of them on the project side, then the risk for the investors that are already in the project that fully funded also goes up because, you know, we all know life happens, things happen. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you have a bunch of partial payments that don't get completed, well, now you haven't raised all of the funding that you need for the project and you're stuck with a lot of partials, right? And so that could potentially put the investors that fully funded in a higher risk category as well from an immigration perspective. And so those are just some of the things to consider. And again,
we saw that, Manuel, in the last couple of deadlines, there were quite a few people who just did a partial funding and then could not afford to go ahead. And it really messed up the developers because the developers gave that particular investor a spot and then lost out on it. I also think that whoever does partial payments also needs to understand there's a lot more paperwork and there's a lot more formalities which you have to go through.
Yes, you have to show that commitment. So if you're not committing the full, you have to show that you're in the process of committing. And so that in itself is a whole new area for us to discuss. But that's the reason why you want to show there's a reason why you cannot commit all the funds at this time. I like to advise the clients that, hey, put the full amount in from the beginning. It's less headache for you, because here's the issue. One, you're going to have to do an interfiling. And for those who don't know what an interfiling is, it means that you're going to submit that second half of your application at a later stage, right? What's going to happen? It could get to USCIS's desk and pair up with your case, right? Because you get the receipt notice. It should be with your receipt number. That never happens, or it rarely happens, right? I see tons of RFEs saying we didn't see the other half of your commitment, and then you end up having to go through an RFE. So even on that front, it's a headache of doing partial filings. Again, I completely understand for certain situations. Like Mona, we've seen plenty of clients come in, their kid's going to age out, you know, going to turn 21 in the next 2 weeks, can't get your funds together. Because like we said, it takes time to liquidate, right? To get $880,000 together in 2 weeks can be difficult. But we could work with it. It's just very limited. And I think it is a case-by-case basis.
All right. Well, so I think that the whole point of this particular podcast was really to discuss the psychology of investors investing only $500,000 and now moving up to what is almost double. I still do not see the rush or people really accepting it. I feel still that it's going to take a bit more time, maybe more than a year and a half. Do you think we'll need a catalyst, Rebecca?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that catalyst is going to come. You know, we're talking about the fee increase in next spring, so spring of 2024. Like we said, most clients I've spoken to don't mind it, but there are a lot of clients who, you know, that extra, what is it? It's going up to 11 or 12,000 for an investor petition. So it is increasing quite a few thousand. So that will matter for a lot of investors. So maybe that will bring somewhat of a kind of like rush filing for spring of 2024.
I agree completely with what you're saying, Rebecca. And I think also just one other thing to kind of consider as well is that, you know, you also have visa capacity numbers that come out, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, if those typically tend to spark demand as well. I think we're also the election, the presidential election here in the U.S. and those things. You know, and then obviously we talked initially about, you know, the reauthorization in 5-year period. You know, those, all of those things are catalysts there. But I think the first one that you're going to see is exactly what you said with the potential fee increase.
Yeah, but this goes back to Mona too. You know, what kind of investors are we seeing or who are we seeing? So China and India right now, that's a majority because they're afraid of backlog. What can we potentially see later?
Yes, I mean, I think that you are going to see other markets start coming up. But I think it's no different than from what we've seen in the past, right? Where you had in 2008, 2009, obviously EB-5 got really popular. There was a big rush from China. You know, that continued into about 2015, 2016, 2017. And then it completely kind of stopped there. And so I think that you're going to see something like that where demand is going to change. And I think Latin America is a really big area. Africa is also another really big market. And so I think there are definitely places where you're going to see investor demand from. I think that the challenge there is just the ability to get to the investors. I think that the infrastructure for EB-5 is going to be a little bit different. I think that's going to be the bigger challenge.
And maybe the 800 won't affect those market as much because we think about it. A lot of these investors came from China, came from India. You know, they already in their head thought of it at 500,000. So maybe going into these other markets, I know we've been in the markets, you know, in the past, but seeing these new markets coming out, 800,000 might seem, you know, it'll eventually be the new norm.
Basically, what you're saying, Rebecca, is that there's no psychology for the new markets. It's the old markets who remember the 500,000, whereas the new markets don't know any better, or for them, it's just an accepted fact. And it's still, let's face it, guys, it's still a lot cheaper than Canada, the UK when it comes back, and a number of other countries.
Yes. And at the end of the day, it's a good deal with where we are right now. It hasn't changed in a while. And so we're lucky enough that it only went up 300,000. I know it seems a lot, but as we're talking in today's market, I think it's a pretty good number.
You know, we can talk about this topic. There are so many aspects which come up, but we're nearing the end. Manuel, I'd like to thank you for your wonderful outlook, and please come back for more.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here again. I think right now it's just a great time for EB-5. You've seen processing times get better. I think RIA put EB-5 in a really good position here to the future. And I can't wait to come back and talk to you a little bit more about all of the other exciting things that are happening.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.